If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
This episode is brought to you by Bai. It's Wonder Water. What makes Bai so great? It's simple. From raspberry lemon lime by Sydney Sweeney to Zambia Bing cherry and Palavo pineapple mango, Bai has antioxidants, electrolytes, and no artificial sweeteners. So for flavorful hydration, choose Bai. It's Wonder Water. Learn more about Bai and discover all of the exotic, bold flavors at drinkbai.com.
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Dalrymple.
It's a very exciting day. I'm
it is quite exciting, actually.
Very really excited. Is. Because first of all, I've had to sort of keep a lid on the fact that I had a sneak peek to your new book. It's so good. Honestly, you are in for such a treat. When is it out? When's it actually coming out?
I am so sending you half the royalties, Anita.
When's it coming out?
It's coming out in September.
September. Okay. September. So this is, I've been badgering William because it is such a work of genius. And please, can we talk about it a bit? Just a tiny bit. And it's very kind of you to lift the veil a little bit for us, because otherwise, frankly, you're going to have an ear bleed because I'm not going to stop going on about it. But we are going to be doing a little mini series. And this is all through the kindness of William and my unutterably awful badgering to just get a little sneak peek of this extraordinary book, which I think, just one gal's opinion, may reframe the way we think about global trade and ancient India. It is that exciting, ladies and gentlemen. But this mini series, this tiny little curtain veil lift that we're doing, we're going to be talking about Buddhism, which is such a beating heart of the new book, isn't it?
It is. So this book is called The Golden Road. And the reason that my publishers have let me talk about it 6 months before this book is actually published.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? Nobody really allows this. So good.
It's very naughty. But the reason they allowed it is that we're just revealing the cover today. And if you were to go to Amazon, not only is the cover up there, but you can pre-order the book as from today.
Can you pre-order the book now? Oh, so looking at it now, it is, well, first of all, William Dalrymple. Very good. We know that's the right book. A superb historian with a visceral understanding of India. That's just one of the accolades and one of the many that this book is going to get and has already got. But this is a picture. Where does it date from? It's a circular road or a depiction of a road with people's houses inside it and on top of it. And sort of these very, what look like ancient Indian miniature people sitting either on the road or in the houses. What does it represent?
So the cover design represents the ancient Indian conception of the world, which had Mount Meru at the center. And then is it six or seven oceans radiating out from there and all the different lands and Jambudvipa, the land of the rose apple tree in the center. So this particular thing is a Jain cosmological map. But it shows how Indians conceived the world in the early centuries. And the book is about, well, this podcast is on empires, and this is about an empire of ideas. How ancient India, rather like what ancient Greece did in Europe, what ancient India did for Asia and for much of the rest of the world. And between about 250 BC and 1200 AD, India was an incredibly confident exporter of its own civilization, creating around it this empire of ideas, which developed into something which I call the Indosphere, this tangible cultural area. And from this, you get this massive transfer of Indian soft power in religion, in art, in dance, in music, textiles, technology, math, medicine, mythology, language, and literature.
When it comes to language, I mean, just to give us a little bit of an idea of how, you know, this spread through the bloodstream, are we talking about Sanskrit? Because there is a wonderful way that Sanskrit was described in your book, that the language of the gods in the world of men. I mean, is that the blood through which it's carried?
That's not me, actually. That is borrowed from a wonderful scholar called Sheldon Pollock. And that's how he describes Sanskrit in one of his extraordinary books. But this idea that there's this cosmopolis, as Pollock puts it, that stretches all the way from Kandahar in Afghanistan, which is the Sanskrit Gandhara, all the way through India, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, right through to Singapore, which is the sort of Sanskrit Singapura. And so, for example, in that area, the name Java, which still sits on our map today, is actually the Sanskrit Yavadvipa, meaning an island shaped like a yawa or a barley.
Gosh.
A grain of barley. And in that area, you get this extraordinary influence of Sanskrit and Indian ideas. So, you know, today, even in the heart of Bangkok, there's Ayutthaya, which is named after Ayodhya, Lord Ram's capital in the Ramayana. Or think of the national airline of Indonesia, Garuda, is named after Vishnu's vehicle.
Vishnu's mount. Yeah.
Exactly that. So it's this idea that, which we've kind of forgotten, that just like in Europe, you get the ideas of Archimedes and Aristotle and Plato circling out ideas of mathematics, ideas of architecture, ideas of the state, of the republic, so that, you know, you go to Sweden or Iceland or Edinburgh, and you have all these buildings that are basically modeled on the Acropolis. In the same way, in Asia, India is this force that's radiating out ideas. And so you, for 1,000 years, you get these pioneering merchants, astronomers, astrologers, scientists, mathematicians. And in the forefront of this are all these Indic religions, Vedic, Shaivite, and Vaishnava Hinduism, and then all the different forms of Buddhism.
Okay. So, I mean, we should explain that, you know, Shaivite and Vaishnava, they're followers of Shiva, who is the out of the triumvirate of Hindu gods, is the destroyer. He does Lord of the Dance, Nataraja, you know, that's sort of one of the three. You've got Vishnu, who is the man who perpetuates life, and he has this spinning chakra on his finger. Brahma, who is the creator, who carries a lotus on his hand. I mean, can I just say, when you're listing all of those things, I'm just trying to get them all in. I mean, you're saying, what, mathematics, sculpture, medicine, astronomy, astrology. You do sound like a Goodness Gracious Me sketch where everything is Indian.
It's Sanjeev Bhaskar again. Royal family.
Hello,
Indian.
Sanjeev. Hi, Sanjeev. Indian. But I mean, you are crediting India with an awful lot. And what did you do to kind of establish those things?
So I think the Sanjeev Bhaskar sketch comes from the frustration of Indians who know, for example, that the number system that we all use, that everyone in Europe calls Arabic numbers, in fact, originates in India. Indians know that half the world's population today live in areas where Indian ideas of religion and culture were once dominant. If you think of Buddhism as an Indian religious system, which takes over not just China and becomes, it for various points in history, the principal religion in China, but also takes over great swathes of Southeast Asia. The fact that the largest Hindu temple in the world is in Cambodia, Angkor Wat, the only temple you can see from space because it's so enormous. It's a kilometer wide. And so I put together all these different things that, in a sense, everyone's always known about. They've been hiding in plain sight and connecting, you know, for example, the Buddhism of Sri Lanka, China, Korea, and Japan, the Sanskrit place names of Burma and Thailand, the murals and sculptures of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata that you see in Laos or Cambodia, or the Hindu rituals that you see in the temples of Bali. And I'm talking about this whole area, this Indosphere, and the trade routes that linked it, which I call the Golden Road, which of the title of the book.
I mean, the Golden Road is, first of all, a beautiful title, and also, you know, this golden thread that links all these thoughts to this very ancient history. Just on that, you know, the Thailand thing, even to people who are Indian and who get it drilled into their heads that, you know, probably everything is Indian, like, you know, me as a parent.
Royal family.
Indian. My son was in Thailand, and he came home, and he was just completely wide-eyed. He said, "Mammy, they've got all of the pictures of the Ramayana. They've got all these sculptures of Lord Rama and Lakshman. And, you know, he recognized them, but was just astonished to find them in a country that...
You don't expect to find them. Exactly.
No.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, not a Hindu country in his mind at all.
Maybe just say one other thing, that what I think in ancient Greece and ancient India have in common, and these are ideas that we're so familiar with for Greece, for Europe, the idea that these countries come up very early with a set of profound answers to the big questions of what the world is, how it operates, why we are here, and how we should live our lives. And India comes up with its own set of answers for this, which not only, you know, take over through Buddhism, China and Southeast Asia, but spread out over a vast area. So that today, anyone that's looking at this through a mobile phone, just look at the keys in front of you. Those are numerals developed in Ashoka's India, transformed in their passage through Europe. But anyway, so it's replacing ancient India in the heart of our thoughts as the engine, a cultural engine in the early classical world, something that's really been forgotten, not in India, but in Europe and much of the West. So this book is an attempt to set the balance right again.
If my dad was still alive today, this would be his favorite podcast. it would be on the shelf marked, "I told you so." I wish he had many exhibits, but this would be the number one. Let's start with something that we desperately need at the moment. You know, you're saying about a philosophy and a way, an ideology, a way of living your life. I mean, God knows we could do with some peace right now. The world has never felt more turbulent and dreadful.
It does feel very, very turbulent at the moment, doesn't it? It really does.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Buddhism, let's go back and back, 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 back. Buddhism has always been equated with peace. So, I mean, where does that all begin?
So I think what I'd love to do in the next 5 episodes is really just trace this one thread of the 3 main threads in the book. The 3 stories I tell in this book are one is the spread of Buddhism, secondly, the spread of Hinduism to Southeast Asia, and thirdly, the spread of Indian numbers and mathematics to the West. And I think just as a little taster, tell the first part of the story of the spread of Buddhism as far as China. And it would be very, very nice if we could just, yeah, focus on that story. And the story begins with the birth of the Buddha.
So we're talking 5th century BC? Is that the time scale that we're thinking of?
Still disputed, and there are various different theories, but now the weight of evidence does seem, yeah, to point to the 5th century BC, which incidentally is the same sort of time as probably Confucius is writing in China, and Zoroaster is coming up with his ideas in Persia. So this is one of those moments in human history when suddenly ideas are changing across the board and people are coming up with new ways of looking at the world and new ways of understanding how to live it. And in India in particular, this is a world going through rapid religious and philosophical change, partly due to the new technologies which have emerged, particularly the iron plow and improved weaponry, which leads to a dramatic shift in the way people live, transforming Indian society from a kind of wandering nomad pastoralism to settled farming, and with it, the rise of cities, trade, and a highly stratified social structure. So all these new things happening, society, which has been largely pastoral, people moving their flocks and so on, is now turning into an urban society with a whole set of new problems that develop when human beings live in close proximity to one another. And you have rapid religious change at the same time provoked by this rapid social change.
So, I mean, just to give people an idea of what was going on, I'm sitting in the UK, you're sitting in India, but this period, this 5th century BC, is the time of the Iron Age, isn't it, in Britain, when people were also, you know, discovering rudimentary tools, tribes were becoming more coalesced and organised, you were having sort of the start of a little pockets of organized civilization.
And all those wonderful hill forts with those deep ditches that you can climb over today. Maiden Castle is probably a bit later, but Hambledon Hill in Dorset is dating from this period. And again, yeah, you have the beginning of urbanization, or certainly, settlements of lots of people gathered together on a hilltop, protected by palisades and ditches and so on.
Yeah, and those sort of Iron Age roundhouses, you know, they're sort of round,
exactly,
thatched.
Nice sort of smoke pottering out of at the top, all those pictures, exactly.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so let's now sort of go back to India. You talked about the new technologies. You talked about, you know, how that moved thought, but in which direction did it move thought? So you have all of these new things that people are able to use to farm with, to have, you know, an establishment of a class, if you like. If you've got tools and you've got those who work and those who reap the rewards of the work, invariably that seems to happen. So what happens to society and thought as a result?
So in India, characteristically, hundreds of new ideas and hundreds of new religions begin to circulate. There's one scholar who says that around this time, there are as many as 66 new heterodox creeds and religions spreading, and there were probably many more. The oldest and the most venerable is Vedic Hinduism, which is the earliest sort of layer of this amazing sort of layer cake that Hinduism is. And the Rig Veda, which dates from thousands BC, much disputed the date, but very, very early, advocates fire sacrifices and animal sacrifices conducted by Brahmins according to very strict rituals. And within the Hindu fold, you're getting alternative ideas arriving in a series of books called the Upanishads, which is the kind of the new teachings, centering on interiority and meditation and looking within yourself rather than to rituals. And then you get these other kind of wackier ascetic cults where people are going out into the jungle and into the deserts and really punishing their bodies. And the most prominent of those are the Jains, and this character Mahavira, who's a rough contemporary of the Buddha, maybe a little bit a generation or two earlier. Mahavira is an aristocrat who, disillusioned by this courtly life, goes on a very austere journey of self-punishment and believes that only by punishing his body can he escape the cycle of rebirth. And one of the early Jain texts talks about austerity is my sacrificial fire, and my life is the place where the fire is kindled. Mental and physical effort are the ladle for the oblation, and my body is the dung fuel for the fire, my actions, my firewood. I can offer up an oblation praised by the wise seers, consisting of my restraint, effort, and calm. So that's the new ideas that have just arrived when the Buddha is a young man.
The name Buddha will be familiar around the world because, you know, Mahavira maybe less so. But if you travel around India to Jain temples are often enormous and
very gorgeous,
you know, beautiful. But you'll have this statue of a youth bare-chested. I mean, he's normally a youth bare-chested, cross-legged Mahavira, you know, the perfect specimen of humanity. There is this weird thing, isn't there, across the world, though, of mortification of the flesh to give you a higher plane of existence. I mean, it's not just restricted to the East.
Well, I think it begins here. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find examples of mortifying ascetics before the Buddha and Mahavira. This is a new idea then, and the idea that you reject this new cosmopolitan urban life with all
That's
the riches and pleasures. And in a sense, you have to have those pleasures and that sophistication for rejecting it to be possible, if you see what I mean. You need one to have the other. And the Buddha is, like Mahavira, the founder of the Jains, a young prince named Siddhartha Gautama Sakyamuni. And Sakyamuni means of the Sakya clan, which is cousins of the Scythians, who we met in our Persian series. Do you remember Cyrus going chasing off into the steppe and being killed by the Scythians? Well, another branch of the Scythians comes to India and settles down beside the Ganges. And it is from a particular clan of the Sakyas who run a small kingdom called Kapilavastu on the border of India and Nepal in the 5th century BC that this young man, this extraordinary young man, is born.
And also, you know, always depicted, the young Buddha is the perfect youth, much like the figures of Mahavira that you see around India and beyond. You know, he's accomplished, he's clever, he's beautiful, he has everything going for him. But for him, it is kind of, I mean, when do we start realizing that it's not enough to have all of these trappings.
So again, I mean, this is that famous thing, you know, the 30-year-old youth, whether it's Jesus or so on. We know that the Buddha, Gautama, was a young prince at the age of 29 when he becomes disillusioned with his cosseted life in the palace. And aided by a faithful servant, he breaks out. And his father has done his best to keep him away from the awful things of reality. And so when he leaves the palace with the servant, he encounters for the first time, in at least in the mythology of this story, suffering, old age, disease, and death, things that everyone has made sure he never sees.
The story is always told there's a high wall around the palace and he can't see over the wall sometimes, you know, but when these stories are told in folklore ways, you know, that he hears the sound of crying, but he doesn't know what it is because he's never seen pain, or, you know, he's that insulated by the high wall. But then at 29, he goes across over the wall. What effect does it have on him? What does it do to him?
So he's distraught and suddenly disillusioned with his comfortable and privileged life. And he abandons both his father's kingdom and his pregnant wife, which is a thing that we find a bit difficult today to stomach when you think about it. And he sets off on this lonely quest to understand the roots of suffering in an attempt to see if he can escape it. And that is the thing that propels him, this idea of escaping suffering. How do you avoid suffering in this world? And he starts off by following the path set by Mahavira and other Hindu ascetics, renouncing worldly attachments, retreating to the wilderness, adopting the life of a wandering yogi under the tutelage of a whole variety of different teachers. And he tries this path of extreme asceticism and rigorous penance. "My body became extremely lean," said the Buddha, according to one early account of his life. "When I thought I would touch the skin of my stomach, I actually took hold of my spine." It's a wonderful image.
We've seen it. You and I were together. Do you remember when we? I think it was in Lahore. We've had the privilege of traveling around the Famished Buddha, which is one of the most affecting statues I have ever seen in my life. So just to describe it to you, it's gorgeous but deeply disturbing. So if you're, you know, one of the people who likes to Google while you listen, just look up the Famished Buddha. But it is of a man again sitting cross-legged. He is so thin, you can make out every sinew and bone in his body. His eyes are hollowed out as if it's a death mask. And he's sitting in meditation. And that, you know, corresponds to the, I touched my stomach and I thought of touching the skin on my stomach and I touched my spine. It's just one of the most extraordinary sculptures.
That's 6th century AD. So it's 1,000 years after he actually performed this.
Right.
And it's in this wonderful half-Roman, half-Indian style made by Gandharan monks in the Himalayas in the 5th or 6th century AD, possibly earlier. Some people say 3rd, 4th, but anyway, the early centuries AD. And the point of this, which is what some people don't understand, is that the Buddha's enlightenment comes not when he's starving himself, but when he accepts a spoonful of milky pudding offered to him by a devotee to rebuild his strength. And it's at that point that he realizes that he must follow what he calls the middle path, the way of moderation between extremes of self-torture and sensual indulgence, between worldliness and asceticism.
And that also becomes a central tenet of Buddhism, even very modern monks. So it just so happens, right, I live in London, on the outskirts of London. One of my neighbours used to be a Buddhist monk. He sadly passed away. So this is in memory of my lovely, lovely friend, Joe, who died.
I've never heard this story.
Yeah, no, Joe, amazing. So he was a fabulous florist in swinging 60s London, doing all the flowers for the Palladium. So, you know, living the showbiz life. I mean, people like Yul Brynner were his best mate. And then suddenly he goes off. He discovers Buddhism. He goes to Sri Lanka to perfect his Buddhism. He goes and lives in a cave where monkeys steal his food. And just sort of lives the life of an ascetic. And when he comes out, you know, the thing again, he says, you know, he walked the path of the Buddha. It was people giving him dana, you know, just food to eat. It was the charity. And right until he died, it's like, you know, there were a few of us on the street who looked after him. But he just sort of felt that he was still living the Buddhist way when we dropped around a pork pie or something. You know, he just and regale us with these stories of how this was the Buddhist way. Lovely man, lovely, lovely man. Nice. But that sort of the enlightenment, I mean, I like to think it's sort of linked to then kindness. The very best of humanity is where you'll find the truth. somewhere.
That's exactly the idea. So yes, to sort of recap, he's 35. He's been sitting, starving himself under a sacred pipal tree, meditating without moving for 49 days. And that moment when he accepts the milky sweet offered to him is when he achieves enlightenment. And with it, freedom from greed, hate, and delusion. And he realizes that this moment of bodhi or awakening is derived not from punishing the body, but instead from simply learning the way to extinguish desire. That's his great revelation. And I've got a little reading, which is not from my book, but which is from the first sermon as recorded in the Pali Sutta. Can I do a little?
I'd love it. Yeah, let's do that. And then we'll go for a break. Yeah, let's do that.
So this is he travels from Gaya, where he gets his enlightenment, now Bodh Gaya, in his honor. And he travels to Sarnath, which is just outside the holy city of Varanasi, just inland from the Ganges. And he sits down and he gives his first sermon. And these are the messages that he gives. He says, there are two opposite extremes that must not be entered into. They are indulgence in sensual pleasure and self-mortification. Between these two lies the middle way, which, if followed, bestows peace, higher wisdom, enlightenment, and ultimately extinction for those attachments which obstruct such a state. The middle way is like a road having eight parts: outlook and aspiration, speech and action, livelihood and effort, mindfulness and concentration, which must all be conducive to the extinction of suffering. Suffering is an immutable fact. It is manifest in the following forms: birth, aging, disease, dying, involvement in the unpleasant, separation from the pleasant, non-attainment of the desirable. I've seen the significance of the existence of this fact of suffering, have recognized the need to understand suffering, and I have made it understood to myself.
Join us after the break. Welcome back. We left you in part one with a reading. I think we'll start with a reading. It's an early Buddhist text. And then, William, maybe you can explain where this is from and why this is important. Formerly, when you were a householder, were you skilled at playing the lute? Yes, Lord. When the strings of the lute were too taut, was it tuneful and fit for playing? Certainly not, Lord. And when they were slack, was the lute tuneful and fit for playing? No, Lord. But when the strings were neither too taut nor too slack, but were keyed to an even pitch, was your lute tuneful and fit for playing? Yes, Lord. Even so is the Dharma that I propose.
That's lovely. So that's from the Vinaya Pitaka, which is an early Buddhist text giving the Buddha's own explanation of his approach to a new disciple called Sona. And the Buddha then embarks on his mission. He goes out across North India, gathering disciples, wandering, remaining always on the move, except during the monsoon, when he takes a rain break up in the Himalayas. And he teaches his fundamental ideas that everything is impermanent and that desire brings only the most fleeting of pleasures. And he teaches that the material world is ultimately an illusion, a dream from which everyone must sooner or later awake. Material pleasures, he says, are like a man who dreams of a fine house with fine gardens and luxurious delights. Yet when he awakens, all of it vanishes. Distinctions of wealth and poverty, noble and common, are like a dream.
So this is, I mean, this is what a lot of people associate with Buddhism even today, that this is all an illusion. You know, everything is an illusion and it is all about the struggle Maya. For higher consciousness. Yeah. But Maya is also a concept in ancient Hinduism. Krishna talks about Maya as well in the Mahabharata, that, you know, none of this is real. He has conversations with Arjun where Arjun is fretting over killing his kinsmen, and Krishna comes down and says, just don't worry, none of this is real. This is all Maya. This is all an illusion.
All an illusion.
So, yeah, so the roots are similar, tap roots, aren't they?
Yes, I think you can exaggerate the distinction between, I mean, today we have this very clear idea that there's one religion called Hinduism and there's another religion called Buddhism, and either you're one or the other. That's not at all how things were in early India. This is very much growing out of the same common culture compost, if you like, of the same ideas. And Buddhism is full of Vedic ideas. However much he's rejecting the ritual side of the Vedas, he's using the language of the Vedas to express himself. So the 12-spoked wheel that becomes the symbol of Buddhism appears in the Rig Veda. And I think it's a great mistake to see Jainism, Hinduism, Buddhism as, you know, three separate watertight compartments. They run between each other.
Or even as a, you know, an apostasy against Hinduism, you know, the daddy religion. It's not like that. They're all sort of, you know, in the same family.
Scholars today often argue that in many ways, the thing that the Buddha is most strongly reacting against is actually Jainism. It's that extreme asceticism. That's the immediate sort of popular fashionable cult that he's growing up against.
Well, we should say what Jainism is then. Yeah. So, I mean, Mahavira, Jainism, Mahavira, but the asceticism is you don't eat meat. You don't eat anything that can give life. So you don't eat, you know, sort of root vegetables, carrots, potatoes, anything like that, because something can grow out of it. Very, very strict Jains, even today in India, you'll see they wander in robes of white, wearing masks on their faces in case they breathe in a bug or something. And there's an awful lot about sort of self-denial as well.
Absolutely. And then there's this thing called Salikana, which I've come across and written about in my book, Nine Lives, where many Jain ascetics at the end of their lives will ritually starve themselves to death. They'll slowly do one item of food less each day. So, you know, first they'll give up dal, then they'll give up rice and so on, and then they'll give up milk and so on. And the Buddha's idea is that that is unnecessarily harsh, that you don't need to punish your body in order to get enlightenment, but nor do you indulge in the full sensual pleasures of urban living and the palace. This is, remember again, is the world that the Kama Sutra is about to come out of. So that on one hand is wrong. Asceticism on the other is not the right way. The Buddha says you've got to find your own way between the two. And the Buddha expresses this message, his dharma, his idea of the moral path, in language of remarkable emotional simplicity and clarity. And he doesn't use the ritual Sanskrit of the Brahmins, but he uses the ordinary Prakrit vernacular spoken by ordinary people in the streets.
Prakrit. Now tell us, I've not heard that. Tell me what Prakrit is.
Prakrit just literally means the vernacular, the ordinary vernacular.
Just chatting language.
Yeah, chatting language. It's what people are speaking in North India to communicate, to buy things at shops and so on. It's not the sacred ritual language, the language of the gods, which is Sanskrit. And his doctrine is at once a philosophy to live by and a method, a practical spiritual path of mental training and discipline, that he assures his followers will free them from the pain inherent in existence. And what's unique about it is it's open to all. You don't have to be a Brahmin or don't have to be a fancy Kshatriya or anything else. Anyone can take this path. It requires no priestly intervention, doesn't involve any rituals or sacrifices, and it only requires trust in the truths laid down by the Buddha and his monastic community. And following this path, he says, anyone can break free from the cycles of rebirth and the bonds of samsara, this idea that reincarnation goes on. And in this way, you can become enlightened, or as they say, obtain nirvana, which means simply a flame blown out by the wind. It's very nice.
That's beautiful. It's a lovely. Yeah, so just to evoke Joe, my friend Joe again.
I love your friend Joe. I'm very sad I missed
him. My friend Joe. You would have loved Joe. I would have. So, you know, I used to ask him, you know, what is the essential belief of your Buddhism? And he said, it's essentially don't be a shit. Yeah. That's it.
That is kind of it. Yeah.
That's it. Which I could sign on to. Yeah. Be more Buddhist. Be more Joe.
And it is, you know, very simply, it's the first religion that is based on the idea of love, compassion, detachment.
And kindness. Yeah.
Kindness, nonviolence, and also this intense meditation and personal self-discovery. And what's also new is the idea that it's based on personal merit, not birth. It doesn't matter if you're a Brahmin or what your class or caste is. And so he substitutes ethics for ritual and makes intention, what you're intending to do, something intensely private that only you know, the final criteria for judging your value. And that's a huge leap forward. That's the first time in human history someone's come up with that formation.
Does he also say that, you know, actually, I'm not giving the power of this. Does he realize he's creating a new religion, or does he think he's just creating a philosophy? And in association with that, does he say, actually, there is no priestly class here? Because, you know, the Hinduism has been interpreted by the saffrons, you know, the Brahmins for so long. Is there that with Buddhism? Or can anyone be a Buddhist?
So the problem is, and in a sense, this is what complicates all this, is that unlike Christianity, where you're getting the first Christian text about 30 years after the death of Jesus Christ, or Islam, where you're getting the first text within certainly 100 years written down, and some of these early manuscripts now, there's one in the University of Birmingham, which is a very, very early version of the Quran, which is much older than anyone realized. With Buddhism, we don't actually have any text that we can date more than about, I think, 500 or 600 years after his death. So everything has been passed on orally, and there are many different versions. And the whole question of how far the Buddha saw himself as starting a new religion or just offering a reform of the existing one, these are all questions that's actually quite difficult to answer now. And one of the things that I think is often very surprising is that when you see the first Buddhist art, it's very unfamiliar. And if you go to the very first Buddhist monasteries, which are initially around the area where he lived, and there's no evidence that Buddhism spread beyond that Gangetic plain, the borders of Nepal and India, the area around Sarnath and Varanasi, that area, there's no real evidence that it spread for maybe 100 or 200 years from that area. And when we do start seeing early Buddhist monasteries and early Buddhist art, it's in a very unfamiliar form. First of all, you don't see the image of the Buddha at all. For the first 100 or 200 years of Buddhist art, the Buddha is symbolized by a turban or a throne or a flaming pillar. And what you do see, which again is very muddling for those who have this idea of this high philosophical Buddhism, is that it's often represented through the prism of pre-existing nature cults. So there are these cults of tree spirits called yakshas and yakshis hanging often very voluptuously from branches. There's the serpents and cobras who live in the waters, the nagas. And they are often depicted spreading their hood over the Buddha as he's meditating. You also get that in Jainism, the idea of a snake protecting the Tirthankaras when they're meditating. And so it's very difficult to tell exactly what the early Buddhists believed and what they didn't. We have very clear central message of compassion, love, the middle way, the middle path, not too much asceticism, not too much sensuality. But exactly what the Buddha was planning, was it his own religion or something quite different, is hard to say. And it's very exciting when I certainly love going to these very early Buddhist monasteries. When you go to the Western Ghats around Pune.
Yeah. Do you remember I sent you those pictures from Bombay of that cave, which had been repurposed?
You went to see a whole load of very early Buddhist caves this Christmas, didn't you?
Just this Christmas. And I mean, just to give you an idea of that sort of, you know, the iconography in there. So this was a cave near a river. And as William explained, I think in a previous episode, but often these things. I think it was one of our extras, actually, so people may not have heard it unless you're part of the club. So come and join the club because you hear all of these lovely extras. But, you know, often near rivers or near coastlines to export these ideas, the monks would build these monasteries or temples in caves. And this one had just beautiful carvings. They look like dancing women, like the most beautiful, rounded hips, rounded bosoms, hands above their heads. And you can still see the whisper of them in the rock face. And then what happened? I mean, the scenes from the Ramayana as well. I mean, absolutely. And there's a Shiv. It looked like there was a Shiv that was carved somewhere in the rock.
So often these caves were shared, or the Buddhists would leave and the Hindus would come in afterwards. Sometimes there are gods which are shared. There's successive owners with new religions. But what you definitely get is this idea that there's a whole world of animism in India. Even today, when you walk through villages, you see trees with threads around them and people worshipping
the
root,
up, yeah.
Exactly, the roots of a banyan tree and so on.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the very earliest times. The very earliest art that we have from India shows these little tree shrines with people worshipping at them and looking for tree spirits. And that gets absorbed into early Buddhism. So what starts off probably as a very pure philosophical path soon absorbs spiritual beings like the Nagas and the Yakshas. And the idea is that these are potentially dangerous spirits, which the Buddha tames with his message. So the first Buddhist art we have doesn't have that familiar image of the meditating Buddha with his legs crossed and his eyes slightly rolled back in his head and this look of eternal peace on his face. Instead, what you get is images of voluptuous women and snakes, which is not at all what you're expecting.
It was confusing. I was confused initially, quite confused. But, you know, William, those are my tiny little Borivali caves just in the suburbs of Bombay. Hardly anyone knows about those. The ones that people travel from all over the world to see are the Ellora and Ajanta caves. Tell us about those.
Oh, God, I love them. So particularly for me, it's the Ajanta caves, which are it's the greatest gallery of pictures from the ancient world to survive.
Where are they?
Inland from Bombay, inland from Aurangabad, in a little valley. They were discovered in the 19th century by a British hunting party that was tracking a tiger down a ravine. And in a very sort of Indiana Jones way, the hunters following the pug marks of this tiger, and they hopped over the rocky bed of the Wagora River, and they see that the pug prints leave straight past an opening in the rock face. And it's clearly not a natural cavity. And despite the long grass and all the creepers and pepper vines and the undergrowth and so on, they can see that it's a man-made facade cut straight into the rock. This is in 1819. And they build little torches of dried grass, light it, and step inside. And they find these enormous holes cut into the rock, hundreds of feet deep, cutting straight into the rock face.
And we're not talking Lord of the Rings. We're talking fine carving. We're not talking like sort of, you know, great slabs. We're talking beautifully carved and ornate.
And they see on the walls, on that very first visit, orange-robed monks with white halos standing on blue lotuses and figures that they describe as figures with curled wigs. And they're crunching over human skeletons and other debris dragged in by sort of generations of predators and scavengers. And the leading guy, John Smith, takes out his hunting knife and in true British form,
just cuts
his name onto a Buddha, John Smith, 28th Cavalry, 28th April, 1819. And I have to say he is accompanied by Sam Dalrymple.
No. Another one,
I'm afraid.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Yeah.
I didn't know that till a couple of years ago. I got a letter.
But can I just say, just defacing the thing with your penknife, how very teen spirit that is. Seriously, Kilroy was here.
You still see it there today, and it does look very Kilroy. Because not only is this just vandalism per se, it's in the middle of what is literally the most beautiful ancient paintings of Buddhist art. They're dated, most of them, there's some which are first, 2nd century BC, but most of the great ones are from the 5th century AD.
Wow.
And it's this lost golden age of painting, that, along with the frescoes of Pompeii and Herculaneum and maybe Livia's house in Rome, or Nero's golden house in Rome also. These are the most comprehensive depictions of courtly life to survive anywhere from classical antiquity.
And the style of painting is not two-dimensional. The shading gives you the impression of a three-dimensional figure. So just to give you an idea of what painting was like then. But also because it's deep down and in these caves, the pigmentation is still pretty true, isn't it? I mean, you see colour.
You get these amazing colours, lizard green, topaz yellow, lotus blues, preserved. I mean, it is fading, and even now they're desperately trying to find ways to conserve it. But amid all these other figures are these two famous, astonishing bodhisattvas, Avalokitesvara and Vajrapani. And they are these extraordinary beings of this kind of symbols of otherworldly beauty, elegance, and compassion. And they're shown with their eyes half closed, inward looking. I don't know how you put it, sort of weightlessly swaying on the threshold of enlightenment.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful 1920s art historian called Stella Cramrish who talks about these bodhisattvas caught in what she calls a gale of stillness.
Oh, is that beautiful?
Isn't that gorgeous?
It's so beautiful. But that is true. You know, if you see these carvings, considering that they are hewn from the heaviest rock, they seem weightless. They seem very light. I mean, it is artistry.
Of the highest order.
Yeah.
And it makes you so frustrated that everything else is gone, that this just one survival of ancient Indian painting. There's a couple of other fragments, a little in Tamil Nadu, one in Madhya Pradesh, but basically it's just this one cycle. And what is wonderful is that these are the oldest images in the Buddhist pantheon, particularly the ones in Cave 10, which date from 150 BC. And you look at these faces and this sort of profound melancholy on their expressions. And they're telling quite sad stories, these Jataka stories of the previous lives of the Buddhas. There's one which tells about the loving wife of a king who is justly accused of trying to kill him. And another tells the story of a boy who is going to fetch water from his parents when the king of Varanasi shoots him on a hunting expedition, or another about a noble elephant murdered by hunters for tusks. So these are all kind of sad stories. And you see these faces. And, you know, 2,000 years after they were painted, these faces still convey with amazing immediacy the character of the different setters, you know, the alert guard, the king caught in the excitement of the hunt, or the obedient son fetching water. And in fact, they're so contemporary and they're so immediately recognizable that you have to keep reminding yourself that these are setters not from our world, that they are depicting a court and a jungle world of hunters and hunted and Buddhist monks and devotees that vanished from these hills 2 millennia ago.
Speaking of deeply emotionally disturbing stories, why was there a Dalrymple there? Go on. Why?
Just on a hunting expedition. When I was researching this, I wrote to this guy called Dieter Schlingloff, that is the great German art historian, boss of the Ajanta world. And he did write as a PS, "Are you any relation to Major Sam Dalrymple, who was there when they were discovered?" And so I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. But it's fine.
The other thing I think we should say is that, again, you know, we have a very clear idea in our head about Buddhism as this very ascetic religion, rightly, because it does, you know, only meant to have a single sewing needle, a begging bowl, 2 robes and some sandals. That's your entire lot. And yet, because the Buddha comes from this courtly world, because he's a prince, a lot of the murals show this world of princely splendor. So as well as all the pictures of monks on the pillars and so on, you get these handsome princes and bare-chested nobles, princesses with tiaras of jasmine.
And jewels, you know, completely bedecked, yeah, with jewels and flowers.
Nothing except jewels. I mean, they're almost naked, these kind of amazing swan-necked women and narrow-waisted dancing girls of incredible beauty. And you can see them swaying to unheard music, wringing their anklets. And, you know, they're wearing nothing but spinels and cat's eyes.
Can I just say, it's a novel way to, you know, give up. It's like to tempt people into a more simple way of life. It's sort of, there was a TV show here in the 1980s called Bullseye, where they always showed you the thing you didn't win. Look at what you could have won. And it's a little bit like, look at what you've given up. As a strategy, it's a bit odd.
There are debates about this, and there are several potential answers to why, you know, all this is shown. And one is that you're trying to actually attract rich patrons to your monastery. So if you have really gorgeous paintings, then, you know, the local prince may come and give you something nice. But secondly, also, I think, you know, it is deliberate that they're showing scenes of fertility. And it's a sign in Indian culture of the period, it's a sign of auspiciousness. It's not meant to be something sort of deeply sexy that's going to distract you from your ascetic celibate way. It's meant to be something which shows the goodness of the world. The other thing I should say is that what, again, is extraordinary and very interesting is we again think of Buddhism as being almost a sort of Marxist religion, in that, you know, you give up your gold and you embrace an ascetic ideal.
And you live with a collective, yeah, a whole bunch of other Buddhists, yeah.
But it's very clear from the beginning that the Buddhists were supported by the merchant classes, and that the patrons who are paying for these pictures and who are paying for the workmen and laborers to come and excavate these enormous halls into the mountainsides, that they are the merchant classes. And from the very beginning, Buddhism becomes a religion that promotes international trade. And what you find is that these Buddhist monasteries begin to occupy the trade routes, that they're often at the vital passes where a merchant caravan might stop for the night. They have guest rooms for the merchants. And fairly early on, again, contrary to all our ideas, they begin lending money. So you get monks setting up copper mines, banks, cotton weaving by nuns, all sorts of stuff that you don't necessarily associate. And there in the frescoes in the Janta are these international cast of merchants who are coming to visit. So you see Persians, Parthians, Scythians, Ethiopians, Egyptians, even Greeks and Romans in some of the pictures. And even the pigments indicate these sort of international connections. The gorgeous blue is lapis lazuli from Badakhshan, from Afghanistan. And so the first caves of the Janta are probably about 150 BC. The big ones are 600 AD. You're dealing with a world which is very international, very cosmopolitan, and which is propelled by merchants.
Do we know, you say, you know, the beginning of his life is shrouded in mystery. Do we know much about, you know, towards the end of his life, what happens to him?
So yes, I mean, he clearly becomes a big figure in a small area of India. There's a whole area around Bodh Gaya, around Sarnath, around the Ganges plains, which becomes partly Buddhist, and which Buddhist monks become part of the landscape alongside Jain monks, Hindus following various versions of the Vedas or the Upanishads, and other sects which have completely disappeared, like the Ajivikas, who are referred to in many early texts, but no longer exist at all. We don't even know what really they believed. And as I say, for the first 200 years, from about the 5th to the 3rd century BCE, Buddhism is almost completely invisible in the archaeological record. There are no inscriptions for 200 years. Not one Buddhist text survives from the period, and only a handful of early Buddhist sites show even the slightest sign of occupation. And those ones tend to be located in this same small area, northeast India, Nepal, bordering the Ganges, where the Buddha had lived and preached. But as we will discover in our next episode, this soon changes, because there is one particular devotee of the Buddha who comes to power. And that man is responsible 200 years later for taking Buddhism, not just right across India and to Sri Lanka, but sending out missionaries all over the Middle East, as far as Libya.
Gosh. Dun, dun, dun. That seems to be a required sound effect for that. Join us for the next in our mini series. We're going to discuss, as William says, how Buddhism goes from India to the far reaches of the world. I mean, Libya, goodness sake. But if you can't wait to hear the episode and you just want to hear it all now, you can if you are a member of the Empire Club. A friend of the show you will become, and as a friend of the show, you can hear the whole Buddhism mini-series right here, right now. You just need to sign up on Apple Podcasts or go to empirepoduk.com and sign up over there.
And Anita, before we go, I have a very, very important announcement. You can pre-order your copies of The Golden Road right now. And the links are in the show notes. But I want to give a special mention to the genuinely incredibly beautiful Waterston Special Edition with astonishing artwork, including on the spine and all over the kind of end papers. It just looks so beautiful. And that will be available on their website to order from Thursday, the 7th of March.
Till then, though, it's goodbye from me, Anita Anand.
And goodbye from me, William Drimple.